Okay, this is session number 21, side A, and it's October 30th, 2006. And we're continuing in the LaRouche section of the book, and we read page 46, 48, 50, 52, 54, 56, up to 58 in session number 20, and took a long time reading all that, and we're going to go over it again to see if we can get some more dialogue about the concepts that LaRouche is presenting. So, we're reading the same stuff we read before, and I'm going to read it, and we're going to try to move through it faster and figure out some patterns. So here's LaRouche discussing the three levels, simple hypothesis, higher hypothesis, and then the hypothesis of the higher hypothesis, which is fitting into the context of music. So he says, themes in music are as lines to a poet. They are musical ideas, even on the level of primitive culture's comprehension of music. So LaRouche here is talking about a universal resonance in what we call separate disciplines, music, poetry, writing, science. He says they're all dealing with the same cognitive processes, okay? Even on the level of primitive culture's comprehension of music. A theme must parse, he says, in quotes, it must have the preconscious form of a musical idea utterance, such that the mind seizes that utterance as a gestalt, something corresponding to a musical idea statement in and for itself. The process of composition then presents the mind with an ambivalence. Each of the musical idea statements subsumed in the developmental process is at first glance an ordinary musical idea statement. It is also essentially something else, a mere predicate of the developmental process whose meaning is essentially the latter. It is the polemical struggle within the mind between the two kinds of meaning, which is the musical experience of the audience. So here's LaRouche is talking about a gap here. Two kinds of meaning, the mind's judgment of them and figuring out how they relate, is the act of creating music. That's interesting, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, from McLuhan's point of view, it's definitely a conceptual approach to things right here, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he says, you got this this ambivalence between two kinds of meaning. Now, certainly this does not sound like music, for the way most people learn music, I don't think. But he says, however, to put the composition together as a unity, the mind must subordinate the theme-by-theme hearing to hearing the developmental process. So it has to know where it's going.
Yeah.
It somehow gets an overview, in which that might be what he's calling the idea. The simple statement corresponds to, now he's talking about the simple levels, three levels. The simple statement corresponds to ordinary knowledge, the developmental process. And now, okay, so the first level, simple level, the simple statement corresponds to ordinary knowledge. You know, these are the facts.
I've heard authors say that. I don't remember who it was, Ayn Rand or somebody was being interviewed and said that it's excruciating, this process of writing a novel, because you have to hold the entire novel and all of its parts in your head simultaneously the whole time you're writing it. Like that, like when we think about the cell having to know each part, having to know what the whole thing is doing in order to be able to, so to have to be able to hold the whole structure in your mind, you know, while you're developing out the parts of it, I think is what he's saying.
That could be that's a good way to do it. So the simple statement corresponds to ordinary knowledge, but then the next level, the higher hypothesis level of Plato, is the developmental process in a great musical composition, and he says that corresponds at best to the higher hypothesis of Plato. Hence the difference between the master of existing musical knowledge, Johannes Brahms, and the creator of new musical knowledge, Beethoven. Brahms is satisfying as a composer because he achieves lawful creative processes of musical development. So he is aware of some process. He is uninspiring relative to Beethoven because Brahms' mastery of music seldom touches those processes which correspond to the higher hypothesis, which is creating a new form. Brahms is to Beethoven as Immanuel Kant stands as a poet with respect to Friedrich Schiller.
Sometimes a musician is accused of being, you know, an aficionado, and however you say that word, in the sense that they really have impeccable technique, but they really don't have the creative inspiration. of another artist who might be expressing something in a more passionate or new way, but may not have, but may not be as technically as proficient as the aficionado.
Yes, and it's like he's saying musical ideas. You need to have a musical idea, a mere predicate, an object of the developmental process. You're working towards some higher hypothesis. You have a vision.
Yeah.
And, yeah, you can just be a technical guy. You're, in McLuhan terms, you just become what you beheld. You're good at working with the environment around you, your musical instrument. But if you don't have a detachment from that and looking towards where to work.
Yeah. It requires the discipline to develop the skills, the skill set to be able to express the insight. Otherwise, insight, I've heard that deep creative insights can actually become toxic to the individual if they have no way to express the inspiration.
Yeah, they don't have the mere predicate of the developmental process. They don't have the predicate, the object.
Yeah.
So those are good statements you're making. So in light of that, let's look at the next paragraph, which he seems to be saying. He says, this sort of use of predicated objects, almost visions and goals and musical ideas, to force the mind to a higher order process conception. Bunch of words to say what you just said. Got to have some kind of overall emphasis. Or that you're trying to discover that in the ambivalence of meaning. So this sort of use of predicated objects to force the mind to a higher order process conception is identical with the notion of higher hypothesis in Riemann's great habilitation paper and the notion of transfinite in Cantor's work. So he brings in and overlaps with science. So he's trying to point out that you got to know what you're doing and you got to know how to create a sense of what you're doing if you're going to be creative in any field.
Mm-hmm.
So he says these are process conceptions. And they occur, process conceptions occur as distinct mental notions in terms of transfinites, as Cantor defines transfinites. They're not finite, they're in a process of transformation. The higher hypothesis of Plato is the highest order transfinite possible in Cantor's implicit schema. Conversely, examining the lawful ordering of Bach's well-tempered system from the standpoint of both Beethoven and Cantor's notion of transfinite orderings, we have a more advantageous standpoint for which to comprehend both the general principle of the well-tempered system and contrapuntal methods generally. So he's saying, and contrapuntal is like juxtaposing back and forth. That's like dealing with the ambivalence of two kinds of meaning. So he's saying that the approach of Plato as expressed through Cantor is, if you understand it, is the way to understand what Beethoven's making.
Mm-hmm.
So this is your, in a sense, this is LaRouche's universalism, that the process of cognition and creativity, its identity is applicable to all creative artifacts and styles and instruments and systems.
Mm-hmm.
So then he's now going to bring in the Arabs. What defines the well-tempered system for Al-Farabi and his European followers through Beethoven is not the matter of agreement of tones as such. It's not just matching. The well-tempered system is defined by the process of musical composition under contrapuntal rules. Counterpoint within any lawful ordering within modes leads inevitably to juxtapositions which are paradoxical. There's your ambivalence again. They contradict the apparent law, and yet they arise to the realization of the law under contrapuntal conditions. So it's almost like you're saying, you got to know how to make the stuff. You got to have the technique, but you don't just remain limited to repeating the technique. You look for new ways to improve on it.
Yeah.
And that's through contrapuntal. It's like creating an environment and then going counter it, an anti-environment.
Yeah.
And that juxtaposition or oscillating back and forth is the creative process.
Right, which is always, it's in the process, and the process is transformative and transforming, and it's a...
And it has a lot.
It's not like a transformation that is momentary, it's a continuous...
Did you say it's not momentary?
Yeah, no, I think it's a continuous transformation.
Yeah.
A transformation along a continuum that doesn't end.
Yes, he talks about the discrete manifold and the, I forget the other term, there's two manifolds. One is the daily discontinuous, and then the higher one is the continuous, what Cantor calls a transfinite, which is the law. Or the pattern that you're groping to see.
Right. I'm looking at the word transfinite in the dictionary, and it says, in mathematics, relating to or denoting to a number corresponding to an infinite set in the way that a natural number denotes or counts members of a finite set.
Yes, relating to something higher.
Yeah, that surpasses the finite. This, again, relates to this idea of jumping the gap between perception of the particular into gnosis of the
universal.
Universal.
Oh, yeah, I just want to, yeah, it's a discrete
and again,
manifold. Here, let me just, it's a discrete manifold of the particulars, and the continuous manifold is the universal.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And
which we're forever excavating or trying to understand.
Right. Last week I invoked his notion of the singularity, which again is this process of things falling into a through a point of infinity. I mean, at the core of the singularity is the transcendence of the particular.
Now, LaRouche operates in the gap between the two. Because he's talking about in between the contrapuntal, what you call the perception, and the universal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And let's look at it that way. See if it follows in his description here. He says
insight into the universal invigorates the perceptual, gives life to it. I think the perceptual just becomes automatic and entropic and runs down. But when confronted with the infinite, or when the gap is bridged, the infinite juices it up and it becomes negentropic and alive and creative.
It's not infinite in any Gnostic or any conceptual way. It's an ongoing groping.
Yeah, but it's a transcendence of time-space, of the particular, of...
Yeah, but those terms are so cliché. He's trying to get us out of the clichés that we've gotten used to.
Like the clear light of the void or something. It has to be a space in which all perception is erased so that new perception can arise. Otherwise, all perception just continues along a sort of continuum. It keeps self-propagating, but it's not new. Nothing new enters into the picture unless it can be, you know, what's that thing, the hand that erases is the hand that creates or something.
Yeah, but the new is paradoxical. Let's not be too limited in how we understand the new. He says the well-tempered system is defined by the process of musical composition under contrapuntal rules. Counterpoint within any lawful ordering, there's your universal lawful ordering. Counterpoint within any lawful ordering within modes leads inevitably to juxtapositions which are paradoxical. They contradict the apparent law, and yet they arise through the realization of the law under contrapuntal conditions. So, yeah, if you're going along a real creative process towards a higher hypothesis and you're following what you know, you will find something that contradicts what you were using to get there.
Right, and it's a reversal, and what it does is it annihilates the thesis. It's the antithesis, yep, which it annihilates the thesis.
Now, he would say it's not the Hegelian thesis, antithesis leading to synthesis. So he's trying not to fall into that trap. So he says these paradoxes are dissonances. They only appear to be paradoxes. These paradoxes are dissonances, lawful dissonances, or singularities within the domain of law. These cease to be unlawful if they are properly developed as transitions to other modes. They remain paradoxical, he's meaning, if you stay within the present mode. Hence, the system of law within composition is not conserved except by allowing for the implicit concurrent existence of every other mode within each mode. That sounds like, you know, letting other modalities in. Simultaneity. The well-tempering principle is determined by this principle of necessary agreement. The values of tonalities are those which admit of coherent lawfulness within the process of musical composition as a whole.
Mm.
Music is not located in the physiology of a human ear or the neophysiology of the acoustical lateral lobe. Music is located in the creative mental processes peculiar to the human being. Now, that would be like in the gap. In the tactile, in McLuhan's term, it is as music is defined accordingly that the distinction between the human and the bestial in various profferings of so-called music is determined. Read that again. It is as music is defined accordingly, according to what he just said, that it's in the creative mental process, that the distinction between the human and the bestial in various profferings of so-called music is determined. This was understood by Plato, by Al-Farabi, by Ibn Sina, and by the European continuators. So it's Plato and then the Arabs and then the Western Europeans. So then he's going to give an example of what is bestial. The distinguishing feature of rock, of Elvis Presley, Bob Dylan, and other aspects of the guitar-strumming modern folk song cults, is that they combine monotony with arbitrary dissonances. Remember earlier we were talking about the paradoxes are dissonances.
But yeah, he's saying that dissonance is a good thing when contrapuntal to coherence,
yeah.
I think.
Now he's saying these are arbitrary dissonances, dissonances that are just made up. They're not the dissonance, the dissonance that is developed naturally out of what you've established so far.
Mm-hmm.
The modern folk song side of this overall spectrum is the most boring sort of monotic strumming, relieved scantily by occasional transpositions. That would be arbitrary dissonances, maybe. The addition of the arbitrary dissonance, sometimes merely whining or cacophonous bellowing into a microphone, is the element of personal style. We call it personal style, or irrational idiosyncrasy. It's not lawful dissonance. It's arbitrary dissonance, added on the tensible pretext of relieving the internal monotony of the rest. There is no doubt that a gifted chimpanzee could replicate every cognitive aspect of this sort of performance. In a chimpanzee, the spectacle would represent, in brief, occasional. In a chimpanzee, the spectacle would represent, in brief, occasional zoo exhibitions, a certain kind of achievement, at least to the purpose of clarifying the cognitive levels of an Elvis Presley, a Bob Dylan, or of any one of a large accumulation of grunters, strummers, and squirmers, or bedrockers. So he's saying that what they are attempting could be summed up if you went and watched a chimpanzee.
Yeah. So then the question arises, why do people like it? I heard Bob Dylan's topping the charts again. Number one in the charts.
Yeah, that's what you've heard lately.
Yeah.
Here on October 30th.
Yeah. Why do people like it if it's so bad?
Well, LaRouche he's always written about how he never identified with popular culture. And if something's popular, it doesn't mean it's significant.
Yeah.
That's his standard non-McLuhanist view.
But it's popular because people like it.
Right. But what people like is just wallowing in their sensory biases and irrational idiosyncrasies.
Mm-hmm.
But see, we're not saying LaRouche is right or wrong, but if you want to argue with LaRouche, that's another matter. We're trying to explain why he feels that way.
Yeah.
Not feels, why he thinks this way. So, we've just laid out this thing about modern music, pop culture is a bunch of chimpanzees. Then let's look at the next quote, which I juxtapose, because it deals with joking. So, how much is LaRouche joking? He says, now he's going to say joking is the same process. The higher formal ordering of joking, as we identified it above, is suggestive of the principles of creative genius. So, the same principles. By being made conscious of lawfulness in the use of a good joke to bring forth important conceptions simultaneously in the minds of a substantial portion of a definite audience, the person experiencing that awareness is made conscious of lawfulness in the ordering processes of his or her own judgment. So here he is applying these verbose, maybe complex arguments to joking.
Yeah,
this is going to sound preposterous.
But he probably is also discriminating about jokesters as well, because I'll bet he didn't like Lenny Bruce.
Yeah. He's saying, by being made conscious of lawfulness in the use of a good joke to bring forth important conceptions simultaneously in the minds of a substantial portion of a definite audience, the person experiencing that awareness is made conscious of lawfulness in the ordering processes of his or her own judgment.
But he never names a comedian that he likes.
No.
I don't know.
Well, he thinks great art. He's talking about great jokes. So he's saying, thus, a poor joke or poorer joke is one which simply plays upon the ambiguities of simple consciousness. There's that ambivalence of meaning.
Mm-hmm.
Without structuring the experience to bring into play a forced reflection on a process of a lawful ordering of insight. He's demanding you to reflect on this process. So he says, the average comedian is poor jokes, but he says what is required to do what he's demanding is a truly great joke. And what is the truly great joke? Not joking, it's art. Art is a truly great joke.
Oh.
So LaRouche considered himself a great artist, so he's telling us these quotes are describing a truly great joke.
Hmm.
This must be a quality of joking one qualitative level higher than the evoking of self-consciousness by good joking. Instead of being merely conscious of the lawful ordering of one's preconscious processes, one must have a great joke which prompts one to be aware of a lawful principle for transforming those preconscious processes. So you're not just trying to make people aware of the ambiguities of simple consciousness or their preconscious processes. You want to show them the lawful principle in them that leads to transformation of them.
Yeah, that's good.
This achievement brings forth the laughter of great fundamental scientific discovery. He's saying great scientific discoveries are great laugh-evoking things.
Mm-hmm.
This brings the consciousness and knowledge of the lawfulness of those mental processes by which one may willfully effect a qualitative advancement in one's mental creative powers. So the more you understand how you can advance your own mental creative powers, the more laughter it evokes.
Yeah, or humor or something. I don't know. He doesn't specifically say laughter when he refers to joking, but...
Well, no, he said that. He said, didn't I just read the word laughter? Yeah, this achievement brings forth the laughter of great fundamental scientific discovery. This brings to consciousness and knowledge of the lawfulness of those mental processes by which one may willfully effect a qualitative advancement in one's mental creative powers. In other words, the more you know what you're doing, you're going to get a great sense of laughter or a joke out of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably because you're feeling the ambiguity, the ambivalence of the process,
mm-hmm.
the apparent paradoxes that are unfolded and then dissolved. So
the yes and the no?
Yeah, the yes and the no. He says in the next quote, and I'm not saying where they're from, that's in the previous tape, just to continue on faster, he says, we've done the joking thing, now here he says, by wide-ranging observations and measurements, Leonardo da Vinci and his physicist collaborator Luca Pacioli demonstrated that the morphological patterns, that's the transformative patterns, of living processes were harmonically ordered according to convergence upon the principle of the golden section. So that was the law. The law of change was the principle of the golden section. And you could see how things changed.
That probably is a tough nut to crack. Do you know what the principle of the golden section is?
Well, it's the... we'd have to have geometry. It's a... a pattern that the Fibonacci circle, the Fibonacci series, is part of what shows in the geometric creation of the golden section. I don't know if he ever describes it, but you'd have to...
Well, I know the Fibonacci spiral, or whatever that thing is called,
yeah.
Is found throughout nature as a pattern.
Right, and that's an aspect of the golden section, but you have to actually do the geometry, which is what LaRouche says you have to do to teach kids. You have to do the geometry to see the golden section. So we're missing that element in our tapes here.
Yeah.
We're not putting people through visual geometry classes,
right.
But see the golden section.
I was looking at a website.
Well, you just need to Google it.
I saw a website on the golden section. It showed it hard to describe on the phone without actually going to buy it.
It showed
tremendous symmetry. And ratio of proportion among proportions.
Yeah. Now, here's what I find interesting is that McLuhan said that the golden section is the Western visual bias version of the interval, and the void or the Zen interval of Asian Buddhism is the acoustic version of the golden section. You know, like the golden section per se is I, but the same sense of analogical proportionality is expressed in non-Western cultures by the Zen interval, as an example.
Oh.
So that's an interesting statement he makes. So one, as you're listening to us, just Google golden section and look at it. But there's a whole course here in unfolding non-Euclidean geometry.
Yeah.
It's called constructive geometry.
I have no idea what he means when he relates it to the interval and the.
I know that. Yeah. Well, we are talking about an interval here between. We should know because we're talking about the interval between ambivalent two kinds of meaning.
Yeah.
And the paradoxes. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's generally within visual space culture in McLuhan's terms that he's dealing with this, but let's just go along with if anybody wants to fully get what we're saying, just Google the Golden Section and then join up to a LaRouche group and take their geometry courses. Then you'll know what LaRouche is referring to. But aside from that, we're moving along here, comparing different schools of thought here and perception, different schools of thought and perception, and we're doing LaRouche right now. Leonardo da Vinci applied this knowledge of the Golden Section to his design of machine technologies, where the principle of the Golden Section and self-similar spiral rotation is used to concentrate the power and increase the energy flux density of the machine, thus accomplishing work. So he used the Golden Section and the spiral to create rotary, early primitive rotary machines. Leonardo recognized that the same principle of negentropy governs the lawful development of the physical universe and the human mind. So not just the world out there, but the world inside us. Formal algebra, now this is the bad stuff, okay? LaRouche is not too keen on algebra. He's keen on geometry, constructive geometry, where the student learns how to create these patterns and how one falls into the next. Formal algebra, like syllogistic systems, is based on the function of the middle term. Now, think of that. Middle term sounds like the gap, but this is the inadequate use of the gap. This middle term has the associated significance of stating such things as, quote, equal to, identical with, not part of, part of, greater than, lesser than, and so forth. The objective of formal mathematics of this sort is to assemble all knowledge, or at least a great part of it, into one gigantic continuous syllogism, such that one might trace one's way from the subject of a single syllogism by way of middle terms through every syllogism in that entire part of human knowledge. In other words, a syllogistic lattice work. So it's like a huge interconnected, in McLuhan terms, visual space rigidity. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So he's saying, then LaRouche says, all knowledge, or purported knowledge, since he's going to put it down, of the syllogistic form is either anarchistic nominalism, such as the irrationalism of William of Ockham, or is formal nominalism, like that of the Neo-Aristotelian scholastics. One is Dionysian and the other Apollonian, but both are pure nominalism or nounism. It's almost like the idea of getting specialist categories and then working frozen in the categories. And being frozen in the categories is not going to make you aware of the discontinuous or discrete manifold where new laws have to be evoked by dealing not with categories but with the paradoxical dissonances. Okay? So he says the practical, and for the average person, nominalism is the philosophy that says the object and the name for the object are not the same thing, that you can actually have any name for something. So LaRouche is not for that attitude. The practical issue is posed by stating that the nominalist approach chooses nouns as the data of experimental inquiry, whereas the negentropic approach, the non-nominalistic approach, chooses data of the form of verbs, which sounds like process, right?
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to categories or nounism. In the latter method, the verb, this is in the Platonic negentropic approach, in quotes, the good approach, which deals with process. It's much like McLuhan's idea of making versus matching, right?
Mm-hmm.
Visual bias people are into making things equal to, greater or lesser than, identical with, matching. And eye bias, well, LaRouche has got an oral bias here. He's saying, in the latter method, the verb to be, quotes to be, adopts the self-reflexive transitive form of itself and becomes to cause itself to become. That's in quotes. This is another way of stating the verb to create or to cause to exist. So he's saying the verb to create or to cause to exist is the same as to be or to cause itself to become. Wherever the verb to cause is employed, the meaning of that verb is referenced hereditarily to the verb to create, to cause to exist, and to the ultimate verb to cause itself to become, which is just what I said, right? Wherever the verb to cause is employed, the meaning of that verb is referenced hereditarily to the verb to create and to cause to exist and to the ultimate verb to cause itself to become. All verbs, at least as they are employed to define data of scientific thought, must be defined by the hereditary principle of connection to the phrase to cause itself to become. So all data of scientific thought must be defined by the action of the verb to be, which is defined as to cause itself to become. So if something happens and is caused to exist, you'll find a lawful pattern underneath it that makes sense in why it became what it became.
Hmm.
Right?
Yeah, so he would, in the sense of propose that there's meaning in all, you can find meaning in any event.
I don't know if he'd say that, no, not in any event. It would have to be the lawful events, the events that are following the laws of the process that you're excavating the nature of.
Mm-hmm.
So let's see if the next sentence answers that. He says, insofar as this pertains to the work of classical philologists, we leave the rest of that aspect of the discussion to them to report how these principles may be located within Sanskrit writings, or at least some among them, and the form of classical Greek used by Plato. Having identified this aspect of the point, we proceed onward. So he certainly doesn't answer what I said. He's just saying, for more work on what he's talking about, go to the Sanskrit writings. So I'll reread that. Insofar as this pertains to the work of classical philologists, we leave the rest of that aspect of the discussion to them, and you can find out how these principles may be located within Sanskrit writings, or at least some among them, and the form of classical Greek used by Plato. Having identified this aspect, the point we proceed onward. So, we're now going to get more on this in this next long quote. The relevance of the subject of well-tempered scales, that's Bach stuff, right? Bach's music. The relevance of the subject of well-tempered scales to our general subtopic here is that the author and his collaborators, that means LaRouche and his buddies, have demonstrated that the discovery of the well-tempered principle depends upon the point of departure of a conception equivalent to the isoparametric principle. Now we're getting into geometry. And is determined precisely by projection of a self-similar conic spiral onto the circular base of the cone. Now when you do project the self-similar conic spiral onto the circular base of the cone, that process leads to the golden section.
Mm-hmm.
The implication of this demonstration is that such notions arise naturally from applying the verb to create to a rigorous study of astronomical evidence. So he's saying, the implication of this demonstration of the self-similar conic spiral is that such notions arise naturally from applying the verb to create to a rigorous study of astronomical evidence. You would find the same law if you applied it to astronomy. Although we can merely infer, if rigorously so, that ideas in this direction were implicit in the pre-Vedic Arctic culture, we have more precise indications to related effect from the interaction of the Egyptian temple of Amun with classical Greek culture. So there's more evidence of what he's believing is the real science in the interplay between Egypt and Greece rather than in Vedic culture and pre-Vedic. And he says, as well as leading internal features of Mosaic Judaism. The specific kind of monotheism about the Temple of Ammon and Moses converges at least upon the consubstantial doctrine of monotheism of Plato's Timaeus. So he's saying Plato is the great repository of the pre-Platonic tradition, which he believes was there, and the transmission from Egypt through Greece and the Judaic culture. Time of Plato comes a good reference point for how to continue this knowledge or this way of finding new technological breakthroughs. He says the essential part, which the notion of a hypothesis of the higher hypothesis, now we're talking about the third level, the essential part which the notion of a hypothesis of the higher hypothesis performs in the Timaeus, and the interdependence of that with geometrical notions rooted in a version of the isoparametric principle is rigorously demonstrated. So he's saying that the hypothesis, the higher hypothesis, the third level, is demonstrated in Plato's Timaeus.
Mm-hmm.
He said, it is only necessary, if we are to make such argument conclusive, to show that in Plato's classical Greek, for example, the verb to be is sometimes employed in the self-reflexive form of it causes itself to become. So he has to show that. He does it through geometry. If physical geometry is defined by a notion equivalent to the isoparametric principle, and if the evidence so ordered is defined as data from the standpoint of the verbal rather than the nominative form, the verb versus the noun, The rigorous development of astronomy for aid of wide-ranging navigation is adequate empirical basis for discovering the existence of a monotheism like Plato's from the evidence of nature. So he's saying that the successes of astronomy are proof that Plato and them had figured this out.
Mm-hmm.
Reading that again, if physical geometry is defined by a notion equivalent to the isoperimetric principle, if you assume that, and if the evidence so ordered is defined as data from the standpoint of the verbal rather than the nominative form, the rigorous development of astronomy for aid of wide-ranging navigation is adequate empirical basis for discovering the existence of a monotheism like Plato's from the evidence of nature. So they got it from nature because they studied the skies.
Mm-hmm.
This is not to project such an advanced form of monotheism upon the pre-Vedic Arctic civilization of interest to Tillack. It is only to indicate that such an urban maritime culture was on the track leading towards such advanced notions. See, there's the law of development. Because they did develop it, they must have been on the right track.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it indicates the reasons why the development of the well-tempered system in music tends to reflect the course of development in such directions. So, later developments of music reflect the same higher hypothesis, and it's unfolding hypothesis of the higher hypothesis.
Yeah, when he speaks in terms of the equal temperament or well-tempered scale.
Yeah.
But then you have these other scales, like, you know, that were developed in Asia, which seem to work pretty well. We're saying that they're not based in truth.
Well, no, that's the Vedic. That would come out of the Vedic culture.
Mm-hmm. But these are different types. These are different scales. They seem to come from a different...
Okay, well, I think we're going to get into that point. How much time we got on this side?
12 minutes.
Okay, so he says, in the same vein, we must compare the degraded conception of man and nature embedded in the writing of Hesiod. That's not good. With the heroic conception of man of the Iliad and the Odyssey. The latter conception better, more clearly defined by Aeschylus, the playwright. Aeschylus' Prometheus rejects the evil gods of Hesiod's pantheon as usurpers and references a higher power, implicitly the composer of Plato's Timaeus. It is provocative to read what Diodorus Siculus reports the ancient Atlas people to say of the Hesiodic pantheon, that all these supposed gods were nothing more than a principally rascally collection of fellows whose civil strife destroyed the culture of the urban maritime colonization of their region. So the maritime colonizers were the ones using astronomy. They were more advanced than the land-based oligarchs, and that the Greek culture of gods, which is a celebration of these entropic humans, entropic, bad, going in the wrong direction kind of culture, is corroborated by Manetho's king list for Egypt. The victorious scalawags of that ancient Moroccan strife employed their maritime culture to colonize regions of the Mediterranean, imposing the worship of their ancestors and associated mythologies upon the credulous subjects of these colonies. So this particular land-based the maritime culture was going backwards. So Hesiod celebrated that pantheon. He says the Hesiodic pantheon was evil enough. So LaRouche is saying that, you know, we think of Greek culture as people who worship the gods, right? There are many gods. And LaRouche is saying that's a degraded form of that period. And there was another culture that we don't fully understand, unless you understand LaRouche, that was there fighting with this, a better culture, which he calls the Platonic thread.
Right. The derived sense of lawfulness, truth, and beauty, and so on, from their observations of nature.
Yes, but not embedded in nature. He, with the goal of changing nature. The concept, so he's saying the Iliad and the Odyssey have these better conceptions than the Hesiod, because he said the Hesiodic pantheon was evil enough. The subtratum upon which that pantheon is superimposed embodies the essential evil, the anti-logos principle. This substratum is the Chaldean Philistine system associated with worship of the earth goddess. Now, he has in brackets the earth goddess, Shakti, Ishtar, Astarte, Isis, Cybele. So Shakti, that's Indian. you're getting into your Asia, and there's an Asian culture that's limited. That's parallel to the Hesiodic. It's not the true culture, which is more the Vedic culture or whatever. He's quoting this guy, Tilak, T-I-L-A-K. Not sure if he's a Vedic man or not, but he could be. But he's Asian, I assume. So he's saying, we think of the yogi culture of Asia.
Mm-hmm.
He's anti the yogi culture.
Mm.
He says that is a worship of the earth goddess, in brackets Shakti or Ishtar or Astat or Isis or Cybele, and her phallic symbol sun, in brackets either Siva, Osiris, Satan, or Dionysus, and also with a third male figure, in brackets Horus, Lucifer, Apollo, etc. This substratum is the irrationalistic, hedonistic doctrine of blood and soil, in quotes, the substratum. In other words, you're targeting people and oppressing them in a landed area, and you're turning them into a colony. You're not moving and progressing and developing new technologies.
Mm-hmm.
So he's saying the roots of imperialism is the doctrine of being devoted to your local neighborhood, your hood, the blood and soil,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
This substratum is the irrationalistic, hedonistic doctrine of blood and soil.
Well, the dialectic between the body and the spirit, it sounds like he's saying that the body is is going to mislead you every time, and you should just be focused on the spirit.
Yes, but he doesn't mean the spirit is the Gnostic spirit or the yogic spirit. That's too otherworldly. He says the spirit is in nature, but you have to have a real smart way of studying it, where you don't try to just create endless nouns. You're looking at the process in nature, and the process implies an invisible or, quote, spiritual law.
Yep.
But he'd be very reluctant to call it spiritual.
Mm.
Together, just because it's so loaded
but
already.
Transcendental, he probably would use that word.
No, he didn't like the transcendentalist Rousseau and, what's it, Thoreau and Emerson.
Mm.
He said those were erroneous Aristotelians.
Mm.
Together, the Hesiodic sort of pantheon and the substratum define the characteristic theology of oligarchical culture. So this is the God pantheon. Just think of our modern celebrity culture. It's like a modern version, from Rousseau's point of view, of the main theology of oligarchical culture.
Mm-hmm.
It's pagan culture. You worship the images. The Hesiodic pantheon symbolizes the capricious tyrannies of a degraded, squabbling collection of families of an ancient jet set.
Mm-hmm.
So he's relating to our time, the oligarchical jet set, same degraded, squabbling collection of families. The philosophical world outlook congruent with such ordering, or pagan ordering of society, is the degraded belief structure exemplified by the cult of Isis, Osiris, Horus. So we know that a lot of the modern-day New Age culture is into Isis and the goddess worship, and that is developed by William Irwin Thompson, who we'll find is on the opposite side of LaRouche.
Yeah, which is probably more sexual and sensuous.
Right, but it's a sensuosity that LaRouche thinks is entropic. LaRouche does write about sensuous development of Platonic knowledge, which would be the materialistic expression of new technologies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, based on the observation of natural laws.
Right. And so you can see why the Vatican supports LaRouche and wouldn't support William Irwin Thompson,
mm-hmm.
at least some parts of the Vatican.
Yeah.
So William Irwin Thompson, when we get into him after McLuhan, will redo some of the same patterns as LaRouche, historical patterns, but from the point that yoga is the secret.
See, when we get into McLuhan and we talk about second nature, it seems like we're talking about laws which have become abstracted from no longer even tangential to these natural laws these first nature laws that LaRouche seems to think we once understood can be sculpted into technology that continues to support humanity in a constructive way. These laws of nature, these laws of media, I don't know that they're fundamentally based in these natural laws. they seem to be discontinuous from the laws of first nature, and I don't know that LaRouche would find them useful.
No, he wouldn't. And because McLuhan is more Aristotelian in LaRouche's terms.
Mm.
Remember, the dialectic of first nature and second nature is a terminology I invented. McLuhan never used that. His colleague, Barry Nevitt, used it once or twice in his later writings after McLuhan died. But McLuhan was always trying to show that media was nature.
Mm-hmm.
And LaRouche would agree with that. But then how and what one...
Well, if you understood the laws of media, according to McLuhan, would you arrive at the same fundamental insight of LaRouche understanding the laws of first nature?
That's the question. That's what we're juxtaposing here. On the surface, McLuhanites do not see any similarity between them and the LaRoucheites.
Mm-hmm.
It was only me and Nelson Thal who have introduced to LaRouche himself the ideas of McLuhan as something he should take a second look at. I doubt if he did, but we said some things to him that made him correct his assumption, because there had been written in the New Solidarity newspaper around 1980 an article to putting down McLuhan.
Oh.
And that paper is written under, LaRouche's ideological guidance. As a matter of fact, LaRouche did say to us, he said, I'll have to take a second look at McLuhan, because we were able to put it in his terms. Basically, the fact that McLuhan was suppressed by the Bilderbergers, that meant to LaRouche, maybe there's something to the guy,
Yeah.
So continuing on this, developing the notion, LaRouche's notion of the cult of Isis, Osiris, and Horus, he says, the contrast between the Promethean man of Judeo-Christian monotheism, which would be like the Platonic man, and